state of hydrogen atom. So the electron is a ground state of hydrogen atom. It spreads over space. It has all the tails. It goes all the way to infinity if it's in the only atom in the world. So we have infinite amounts of information in all these values. The question is, can we check all these values with a single electron? And the answer I suggested, this was my original idea, that if I come with a measuring device that interacts with this atom so slowly in time that it doesn't cause any excitement, because in order to excite the atom, you need frequencies of the order h bar omega should be of the order of the difference at two energy levels. So if I interact very weakly with this atom over a long, long time, and I'm very careful not to cause any jump to any other level, then the only thing that I will see will be properties of this level. So for example, if I couple to any to the projection operator in a given region of space for the electron, then the only thing that I can get, if I don't go outside, is the average value of that, which is psi sub psi. So indeed, we were able to prove that in the limit of very, very slow experiment that lasts much, much longer than 1/energy difference, you can see all the details of the wave function of a single electron. So this is called now protective experiment, and it excited many people because they said, aha, this is the first time we can really give a meaning to a wave function for individual particles. So my purpose now is, of course, to undo the harm that I've done and to show that it's a confusion. And maybe I will do it now, because it's so important, I want to undo this harm already now. So to undo, by undoing the harm, I mean, I don't want people to begin to believe again that it's a single time the pattern is described by all this amplitude, because at a given time, the particle cannot be spread. Maybe when we talk about a very long time, we'll see some way to understand the psi meaningful in a long time. And in order to do that, to be a digression, I go to classical physics. Maybe I will talk about it briefly here, but I will do it again. In classical physics, I take a cavity that I keep the walls of the cavity at temperature T. I think I discussed it once briefly, but let me do it again. Then, and suppose inside this cavity, I have many, many non-interacting atoms, like a gear gas, and they are in equilibrium with these temperature walls. So we know, as Boltzmann told us, that if we look at any individual molecule or atom, we find that even though we know to a very good accuracy the initial condition, initial time, in general we have only probability to find out any of them at any given position because their behavior is essentially chaotic. So we can say that in classical physics, we will have only a probabilistic statement about each one of these molecules, and the probability to find it at any location, at any kinetic energy, is given by e to the minus the Hamiltonian divided by kT. The Hamiltonian includes kinetic energy, so the probability to find the kinetic energy is given by e to the minus mv squared over kT. And the probability to find the location of any atom is given by e to the minus the potential divided by kT. So we can say that if we have an ensemble of such atoms, by looking at the ensemble and making measurements of the position of each one and the velocity of each one of these molecules, we will find by calculating the average this function as a property of the ensemble. So the ensemble will have this Boltzmann distribution sitting there. But we can ask another question. Suppose we just have a single atom. And the single atom starts with some velocity, known velocity and position. It comes to this wall, when it comes to this wall, it's going to be hit by some particles oscillating the wall. So it will go to some other direction, because, and then it will go to other direction. Eventually, it will make very, very complicated motion, because the walls are not perfect. They're not like perfect mirror. We get knocked by atoms in the wall. So we'll see very, very complicated motion. And if we do the following question, we put here some measuring device that gets activated each time the particle passes this region, and then we can measure how long did the particle spend in this region if we calculate a very, very long time. So the ratio of the time that is spent here divided by the total time will be the probability to find the particle at this point here, and that probability must be exactly like this. That means that if we have a single particle, the Boltzmann distribution can be measured on it if we are willing to do an experiment that lasts a very, very long time. But that doesn't mean that we can say that that Boltzmann distribution really describes the particle at a given time. At a given time, it's described only by x and v. So that's what happens with the wave function. The wave function, if we have a single individual time, we can measure the wave function only if we have an ensemble of particles. All of them are described by the same wave, and then by measuring probabilities, we find out what is this wave. But only by looking at the sample if we do it a single time. Now comes the protective measurement and tells you, you have now a single particle, but you have a huge time at your disposal. You can find, indeed, what is psi. Does it mean that the particle was described at any instance of time by psi? No, because we can show later I will do it, by post-selection, I can arrange the situation that measurement that gave me that average over time, that psi sub psi, was due to the weak values of both boundary conditions that will show that actually the particle was oscillating back and forth. So, this is going to be done in the future in one of my future lectures in detail, but I wanted to make sure now that I immediately take care of this idea that we have shown, that I, of all people, have shown that psi has a meaning, right, for a single particle. So I want to make sure that this, actually, historically, when I did it, I thought that maybe I'm going to show it. But then I realized that that's not the right way to think about quantum mechanics, and I want now to disqualify the idea that the protective measurement indeed show you that psi has a meaning to describe a given particle at a given time, because there is no physical significance we can give to amplitude, as I said. Now, I want to tell you that during the weekend, I had an... Yes, question.
Sorry, quick question. So what is the relationship between the path of the particle, which it actually follows,
I can't say that the particle follows the path. What I can do by post-selection, for example, in hydrogen atom, what I will do for my post-selection, I will post-select a state of a Rydberg. You know, Bohr has shown that if you go to a very, very excited state, you can find by superposition of excited state, something that behaves essentially like a classical particle. This is the correspondence principle. So in this correspondence principle, I go from quantum mechanics to the corresponding state classically and see how the limit works. So I will take my hydrogen atom that is in the ground state, do my experiment very well. Then at the end, I will postulate the electron in one of the Rydberg states. So then we move around the atom with essentially without spreading many times, that's like the solution of the Earth around the Sun, because it will be essentially classical. And then I will see that the thing that I got in the middle experimental time was the combination of this essentially classical motion and the other. And the combination of them gave me this psi, okay? So it's not that I do a postulation define for me a real orbit in space, but it defines for me the best, the closest thing to orbit that I can do, which is the Rydberg state in the case of hydrogen, or coherent state. Suppose I have an harmonic oscillator, I have the ground state, I measure all the psi, all the e to minus x squared. After I finish, I do a postulation of very highly excited coherent state. This goes back and forth, and the average of this combined density will be what I see. Okay? Yes, Ari.
As Judge Judy said, if you have done enough damage, so I want to see. There is a saying by Judge Judy, you have done enough damage. Never mind. I want to ask you about a group of frogs of yours. Usually we think that
about
there
what?
Is a group of frogs by yours, which I want to know.
Group of experimenters, you mean, or what?
And theoretically.
Okay. Yeah.
Then I want to know whether your preservation now applies to them. We always thought that you cannot observe the wave function.
What?
We always thought that you cannot observe the wave function because it goes against the uncertainty principle.
Yeah.
And I always thought that one of your great achievements is that you manage some, you always say, just watch. Here is the wave function. I thought that it's beautiful.
You mean the protective experiment?
Right.
Yeah.
So are you now telling me that I should not appreciate this and...
No, you can appropriate this as an example of beautiful measurement of weak values. Okay? What you measure there are very interesting weak values. Let me discuss protective measurement either at the end of this session or next session. I don't want to have too many digressions. I wanted just to explain what we were discussing, but let me come back to the main line of my teaching about the non-local thing. Now, I want to tell you that during my thoughts in the weekend, I came to a beautiful, what I think a beautiful way to explain what happened at the beginning of last century. What happened with relativity, what happened in quantum when quantum mechanics was discovered, and why the fate of both of them was different. In case of relativity, we could develop clear intuition. In case of quantum mechanics, we found this is very difficult. I have now a very interesting understanding that I want to share with you. So here is classical theory. Classical theory. And I can go with classical theory in two different directions. I can go in the direction of relativity by switching on 1 over c from 0 to something finite. Or instead, I can go to quantum mechanics by leaving c infinite and switching on h from 0 to something finite. And then I can go also in this direction. First, I switch on relativity and then go to quantum mechanics. Or first, I switch on H and then go to relativity. Okay? These are all the possible ways of... and of course, I can do the most complicated thing, go in the middle, switching all of them together, both the C and H together. So I said that historically what happened, I claim what happened without realization is that first Einstein went this way, he analyzed special relativity without any notion of quantum mechanics because he never worried about the fact that his clock. It helps?
Try to reduce glare on the blackboard.
Yeah,
that's correct. We should go to see.
That's okay. No sound coming from there.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Oh, right. This is so good.
Yeah, much better.
Okay, when Einstein analyzed the first experiment, his famous first experiment, what happened when you measure the difference of time at different points, he used rulers and clocks. He used rulers and clocks, this was classical. He didn't worry at all about the possibility there would be some uncertainty in this measurement, because that would have made this very complicated. So he was lucky. He thought that he just had to worry about classical rulers and classical clocks and measure what happens if the velocity of light is finite. But when people looked at what the sort of experiments for quantum mechanics, they didn't realize that automatically they've already assumed that we are at this point, that C switched on. Because they only looked at Hamiltonians for particles at the form p squared plus v of x. V of x could be arbitrary, you could put potentials that are periodic, but p squared was p squared. They did not realize that if they would have gone from classical theory only in this line, not worrying about that, then the canonical formalism of classical theory for Hamilton equations of motion treats x and p on equal footing. It's very important. So if we look at phase space and we look at classical physics without knowing about relativity, it's not there, c is equal to infinity, then on this phase space, when people were doing Hamilton formulation of classical physics before the time of relativity, they were considering arbitrary Hamiltonian of x and p. They considered transformations that made symmetry between x and p. You can make canonical transformations that x was going to p and p goes to x. And if they would have quantized, think about what that means to quantize this kind of formulation, where we have arbitrary Hamiltonian, not just Hamiltonian of the form p squared plus v of x, then Schrödinger representation will never happen. There will be no discussion at all about wave motion, because wave motion in the amplitude of the vector in Hilbert space comes only because of this form. Only there you see a wave equation for the amplitude in position representation, because this is minus z squared dx squared, and therefore this plus v of x is equal to I dt. This is a wave equation. That wave is there only because you consider Hamiltonians of the form p squared. If you had an Hamiltonian of the form cosine p, plus cosine x or plus anything, then the particle will jump. That will be the most important thing. There will be a wave appearing. What will be appearing when you quantize classical physics of arbitrary form in Hilbert space, the new thing will be jumps, not wave motion. So if I have, and that's why I wanted you to try and get acquainted. Somebody left me a beautiful thing here about exercise. Who did this? You? No?
Maybe.
Who?
Maybe.
Somebody did it.
This is a piece of paper.
Who did this?
Thank you. That explains.
That's a mistake.
Is it?
Huh?
Is it anonymous?
Anonymous.
There's a half of pi, if that's
who did it?
No.
Let me know.
It's Matt Damon. Yeah, I think so. The after that, the Jeff in that's the real
Harry. It's not me. Oh, no, it's me. Wonderful.
Me.
I'm sorry, it's me.
Wait, you? Okay, this is very, this is extremely important. I want to say it once more. If people would have come to quantum mechanics to first switch on H without going this line, without going with C, then they would have done, they would look at all Hamiltonians that people discussed in the 19th century, and they were therefore discussing all Hamiltonians that are arbitrary functions of x and p, and see what will happen when they quantize that. And then it turns out automatically that what you will see as the difference between classical and quantum mechanics is not a wave notion, but a discontinuity.
Yeah.
jumps. The basic dynamics will be jumps. I start with a particle here, but jump here, here, here. And I will see the classical motion only as an average of jumps. So jumps. And this indeed, when Heisenberg tried to write his message set, he actually did it with jumps, because he could not write, when he writes a metric for position and momentum, the way that he wrote it, it was a discrete, infinite, but discrete metric. So the answers here were position, and the answers here were momentum. Here, position was discrete. So we discussed really a discrete lattice, and the momentum would be jumped from one point to the other. So the Heisenberg formulation from the beginning was that formulation that is suitable for discussing what would happen if we go to classical, from classical to quantum mechanics without switching on C. Then, indeed, that is the correct approach. So I claim that the Heisenberg is the correct approach to understand what is new in quantum mechanics compared to classical physics without mixing it, mixing in relativity. Now, one more important comment. If we try to mix in relativity, then our notion of saying that quantum mechanics of particles, when you consider not absolute time but Lorentzian space-time, then it's tricking to say that this is a single particle wave equation, because we know that if the velocity of light is finite, we know that if we have an electron in the atom, say this is a hydrogen atom, the proton is here, the electron is a wave here. Suppose we try to give a meaning to that thing by saying what will happen if we look to find the electron close to the nucleus by trying to make a measurement to see where the electron is located. We know that if we try to locate it a distance of the order of the proton of the nucleus, we will immediately create pairs, because the minute when we try to localize any particle better than h over mc, the quantum wavelength, automatically we create pairs. So the notion that we write a position representation for electrons, this is a mistake, because we never can consider really amplitude at eigen state of position, because the minute we try to localize better than the quantum wavelength, we produce pairs. So it's always just an approximation. So the idea that we know how to understand really quantum mechanics when we already switch C is not a pure thing, because we have immediately to go to field theory. If we try to use particle theory with definite number, we should better consider it not in Lorentzian time but in absolute time. So this is a very important lesson. And when we try to do it not in Lorentzian time, but in Galilean time, then we are allowed to consider Hamiltonians that are of the form cosine p, and we should then ask what is new in quantum mechanics compared to classical physics when we go in the line when we don't switch C. Okay? Then we find that we have no notion of waves at all. This will never appear, because the equation of motion for the amplitude of position will not be a wave, it will be jumps. I will jump from this position to this. Nobody would consider waves as a possible notion. This is very, very important. So it's so important that I will stop now and answer here about 10 questions. I'm not going to continue. Okay. So now ask questions about it.
You say the behavior will be jumpy instead of
continuous. What?
Say the behavior would be jumpy instead of continuous.
Yeah.
But this is just for one kind of a Hamiltonian.
No, but in general, Hamiltonian will be... Okay, let me give you a beautiful example of an Hamiltonian that we have both jumps and continuous motion. The most interesting thing in quantum mechanics, the most dramatic thing about quantum mechanics is the Bloch behavior that is important for all the beautiful thing that happened in solid state. So what is the Bloch Hamiltonian? You have an Hamiltonian, which is p squared over 2m, plus a cosine x over x0, and then you also add what happens if we add also a constant field. So I have also an epsilon times f0x. This is a very interesting Hamiltonian, Because this shows the following thing.
I'm sorry, Jeffrey, what is the last one?
Huh? What?
Constant force.
Constant force, right. Now you see. And there is some coefficient here also of lambda that has dimensions of energy, okay? So what Bloch showed was an unbelievable behavior of that thing, that if we look at the energy versus the momentum before you have this term, so the energy is equal to p squared, you have the term like this, you see that the particle started here, and it has some velocity, and then it keeps going to bigger and bigger momentum, and it keeps increasing the velocity. But the minute you have this thing, something very interesting happens. At the place, this thing makes a jump in momentum. So if you are at this momentum, it can make a jump to this momentum. These are degenerating energy. So you have to solve for the two possible degenerate energies. They split. One of them goes up and the other goes down. That means that you produce a gap here, a gap in energy. You produce a gap in energy. And now something very interesting happens. If you start the particle now at a given momentum here, you put a force. The force increases the momentum until it comes to this thing, and then the momentum starts to go down again. The particle behaves like this. And that is because of the gap in energy. And that's why you have all this beautiful behavior in solid state. Now suppose we do now the same thing, but reversing the role of X and P. So I have now an Hamiltonian, which is equal to X squared. Let's forget about all the codes. Okay, lambda 1 X squared plus lambda 2 cosine P. P x0 plus lambda 3 x. X of P. Lambda 3, let me see. P, right. So first of all, if I don't have these returns, if I look at the energy versus the position, then if I don't have these two terms, the position is a constant of motion. So I just have an energy that is now periodic as a function of position, not as a function of momentum, but as a function of position. So here's space. I put the particle is a stress, and it has energy proportional to x squared instead of to p squared, to the location. Now, if I only add this term, then I will have x dot, the particle will start to move from one location to other slowly and increase the energy accordingly, right? But if I switch on this first without that, then I see that if I start the particle at some location here, the particle, then it can jump either here or here because of this term. So when I combine this, all of this, I find something extremely interesting. I see, suppose I start the particle, this is start the particle's position here. This is the energy is a function of position now. I start the particle with this position, and because of this term, it starts to move, until it comes to some point here where it pays it to jump from here to here because it has the same energy. So we see this particle now moving in space. Particle will start to move, and suddenly it jumps here. Then it starts to move again, it jumps here. You see, this is what this Hamiltonian will do if you change the role of X and P. So I'm saying, as you said, I don't need just one. I can have number of cosine, but I have to develop a completely new intuition about space if I try to go from classical physics to quantum mechanics when I treat X and P on equal footing. That's why I thought it would be very interesting to look at very simple example, because the minute you see more complicated one, it becomes beautiful. You have to develop completely new intuition about space-time if you quantize classical physics without switching on C, because only then you are allowed to introduce cosine P Hamiltonian. You remember what I showed you. If you see finite, if you have Lorentzian space-time, you are not allowed to have cosine P in the Hamiltonian. Let me remind you why this is the case. And this is x, and this is t. Suppose I have, first of all, a free particle. So a free particle with three infinite massive particles. So it stays at rest. So the particle stays at rest. And then if at given time here, I switch on in the Hamiltonian cosine p, I suddenly put in Hamiltonian extra term cosine p, what this will do, it will make with some probability to an immediate jump here and an immediate jump here, with some probability. So under this condition, I see if this jumps realized, the particle was moving up to here, and then it continues from then to move here, or here, because of the cosine p, because it may jump. Now, in absolute time, there is no problem. The number of particles conserved. I have a particle here, and I have a particle there. Or probability half here and half. But if I go to Lorentzian time, and look at this as an equal time, I see that in this case, I have a particle here. I have also at that same time a particle here, so I have two particles. So the number of particles is not conserved. I am not allowed to introduce any non-local jumps in Lorentzian space-time. But in Galilean space-time, I am allowed. And I am saying, therefore, that without realizing it, all the sort of experiments that people were discussing in quantum mechanics, they became so unbelievably impossible to understand, was due to the fact that they went in the line where first C was switched on and then H together. Then they could only look at Hamiltonian, which were P squared plus V of X. They saw immediately wave equations and they say, the most important thing is this thing that the particle also is wave. Because that's the only thing that they could see in this type of formalism. If it's a wave, then we have to explain what it means for a single particle to be in all these locations at the same time. And then nobody understood what it is. And therefore they raised their hands and said, okay, we should never try to understand what it is. We will learn just to calculate it and understand only what happened when we look at measurements of position. That's what happened. That's why Feynman said, don't ever try to understand what it means, because you will get crazy, more or less. So now I'm saying that if we consider a much simpler task, first of all, and that is only to quantize classical physics without worrying about relativity at the same time. It's too complicated. In fact, when we try to mix the two together, we even do something that's absolutely wrong, because we don't have any more a theory for a single particle. So better, let us consider something that we are sure is consistent. Namely, take classical physics, we have absolute time, the Galilean time, and then we quantize it, then there is no problem. We really have a theory where we consider definite number of particles, C is equal to infinite, so we never create pairs, so it's absolutely consistent, and see what are the consequences if we quantize classical physics with Galilean time. When we do that, then we say, let us look at all the beautiful results of canonical formalism that use beautiful transformations in phase space where X and P were equal footing, there were X and angle variables, there were all kinds of fantastic information about classical physics when you do this general idea of phase space is symmetric. And you can discuss all symmetry in X and P. Then when we try to quantize it, you find that the most important thing is that the motion now in phase space, instead of being continuous, it jumps. When we quantize quantum theory with the P squared plus V of x, we know that when we have cosine ift, the motion in phase space is not continuous because the particle jumps in momentum. So there are jumps, but jumps in phase space, but not jumps in ordinary space. But if we consider quantizing a symmetrical classical physics, then we have to consider also jumps in space, and these are the real things that usually happen. So we will never come with the notion of continuous wave motion. This is foreign to this theory. In this theory, we have to consider the basic notion of the motion of jumps, and then to ask n non-local equations of motion, and to ask how to understand there what happens when we go to the classical limit of this theory, how to understand the interference phenomena, etc., from this language. And then we will see that in this language, the thing that plays a role is not to say that a particle is the same time at two locations, say the particle can be at one location, it has another property which we can measure, and we will see, and this is the modular momentum, and this will be completely consistent interpretation of what happened if we learn to think in this language. And I will try to go a little bit further in this language after the intermission. Yes?
Just a point, I mean, you're saying that the Schrödinger equation in the generic case is not a wave equation.
Right.
And so
Schrödinger equation is just a special equation, yes, trying to see what happens to the vector Hilbert space by looking at a particular representation which are eigenvectors of position. Yes. But there is no reason to look to do it this way at all, because we can use eigenstates of momentum, we can use eigenstates of modulo momentum, modulo position together, which will be better. The reason why Schrödinger equation was chosen in the case of actual case because we only looked at very special Hamiltonian p squared plus v of x. Then indeed it pays to look only at the representation of position because you have very nice simple equation, wave equation. Yes.
I just want to take issue with even calling it a wave equation. It's not really a wave equation. The wave equation has d2 by dt squared.
That's right. Yeah.
This has I d by dt. It's really a diffuse.
Yeah, it's a wave equation for a complex wave.
Yes.
Right? Okay. Really, we need to accept that.
It's a diffusion equation in imaginary time.
Oh, okay.
It propagates so-called waves at infinitely fast speeds, right?
Yeah.
So by some wave, the tables go to infinity.
Yeah, if it's okay.
In zero time.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Okay,
yeah,
I agree.
Call it a wave equation.
I know, but nevertheless, with a little bit hand waving,
yeah,
we get a nice wave, sure, and that's how Schrödinger won against Heisenberg.
Sure.
He said, look, in my representation, I can explain everything that you are talking that's so complicated with geometry. He said, I have something very simple, just a wave. But the reason why he had this wave is because he was quantizing the wrong theory. Heisenberg was right.
But
so,
I wonder if there might be some analogy, because it is a diffusion equation. Obviously, diffusion does describe jumps in a diffusion equation is a continuum approximation to jumps. Maybe, in a sense, one could look at the diffusion equation in the same way.
Yeah, I think you can assume that I have kind, if I look at analytic functions, you know, then I can take care of not going immediately to infinity. That has to do with cutting it. Suddenly, if you have only finite limits,
it will go.
Yeah, the limit you cut it goes. But if you have, for example, a Gaussian initially has spread over space, then its time evolution is. Okay, let's not talk about it. Look, since I'm killing it anyhow, you can. you kill it more slowly than me, so I'm winning, okay? Okay, let's have an intermission. All right, questions?
Yes.
Yes.
I've always thought it was strange, but the state space of quantum theory allowed an object to sort of continuously vanish from here whilst reappearing slowly here, and the whole process is continuous, but at no point does it pass through the cracks in between.
Right.
And you seem to be saying that we should really understand quantum theory, taking full advantage of that aspect of the theory. So an alternative idea would be that there's something wrong with that, and that to develop a fully sort of special relativistically invariant approach to quantum theory, we should change quantum theory in such a way that's not there. Presumably you wouldn't support something like that.
No, I would say first of all, that if I want to really discuss a theory in which particles are conserved, so I can speak about this quantum theory of individual particles, I have no escape from considering absolute time, and then this kind of behavior will be allowed, and we can develop intuition what it means if we do quantum theory, for example, on a grid of points, and only have jumps between them, and see if in this kind of approach, when we go to the limit of very long wavelengths, we get back the usual continuum, just like they do now in field theory when they put it in grid, on a grid, and they say in long wavelengths we discover back the Lorentz frame, but for short times and short space we have jumps, okay? So I'm saying this idea, it suggests that if you first of all assume that the velocity of light is infinite, you can discuss absolute time, then it's very interesting to see what would quantum mechanics look in that case. I'm saying that when we learn intuition, when we have intuition developing from this, we'll see that it will help us when we come back to the usual condition, it will help us to see it in a new light. Not that I would then say that there are jumps, but we will say that we will see in a new light how to explain what is happening, not by using the continuum Schrödinger equation, but by using the Heisenberg picture that actually remains essentially the same even in that case. So there will be something that we can borrow from our new understanding from a truly classical quantum mechanics, classical in the sense of classical space-time, you will see that enough of it will be left also when we go to the Lorentzian space-time. So the intuition we will develop from that will help us to see what happens in real Schrödinger equation when we don't have to think about the wave being spread over space, but instead we have to think about these amplitudes as mathematical things that tell us what are the probability to find the particle given location, but the interference will be explained in looking at the properties of the modular momentum that is left over from the truly non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So that is the lesson I'm trying to develop. So there are two issues. One is that if we ask why is the fate of quantum theory and relativity so different, in the case of relativity, it was possible to find a very nice story from the beginning. And instead of quantum mechanics, the story that we found was very baffling and we don't understand it. It's because when we do quantum mechanics the way that we have developed it after relativity, we try to do something too complicated. We try at the same time to quantize and put a Lorentz frame at the same time. I'm saying that if we would have developed quantum mechanics first, in the way that Heisenberg taught us, we could develop a story that would be very nice. And the reason why we were able to do it is because we tried to make a jump of doing C and H at the same time. So I'm saying that even for Einstein, if he had the complication of having to use his rulers and clocks, using also quantum aspects and not only the relativity and not only the velocity of light, he would find it very difficult. So he was lucky. He used only the transition from classical physics to switch on finite C without worrying about the quantum effect and quantum frames of reference. That's why he was able to develop such a nice story. On the other hand, if he would let Heisenberg do, not worrying about space-time being Lorentzian, but instead being Galilean, then he would win. Schrödinger would not be able to develop his wave equation, there will be only the Heisenberg thing, and we'll have to explain interference phenomena the way that Heisenberg explained it, and that will be a much better story from the beginning. Okay, and then we can combine the two and see what is left out of both independent story that will survive when we do the two things together.
Yeah.
That makes sense?
Yes, it's great.
Good. Yes.
You are saying that the end result, no matter which way you go in the diagram, this or this, this or that, is the same.
Of course, yeah.
You're not trying to say that the diagram doesn't
But the story that we end up telling depends on which route we are taking. That's what I'm saying.
But the
story. Yeah, all the experimental results will be the same, but the way that we will try to understand where they are be above the mathematics, that the story will be different if we follow one route or the other. And if we follow the other route, it will be a much better story. That's what I'm saying. And I say that it's very important when we consider physics, not only to have the right mathematical formulation and the right prediction, it's just as important also to have the right story above the mathematics, because only then we could develop intuition that it depends on the mathematics, that will help us to ask questions, not being guided by the mathematics. So if we are guided by the mathematics only of Schrödinger formulation, there are many things that we would not be led to ask even, because we don't have the right story to tell. Any other questions? Okay, first of all, let me remind you that there are a number of debts that we have from previous lectures. One debt is from the last lecture. I gave you a paradox and asked you to try and solve it. You remember the paradox? I have a solenoid inside the superconductor, and the solenoid is a superposition of two different fluxes. That means that there is some complementary variable that is defined there. If instead of solenoid, I imagine that the thing that produces the flux is a cylinder with charged smears on it, and if it's rotating, it produces a flux, and that cylinder can be put in a quantum state of rotating one angular momentum or another angular momentum. That means producing one flux or another flux. A coherent superposition of these two will give us some information of the angle probability distribution from this cylinder. Eventually, all the cylinder will draw a line. If the cylinder has a definite angular momentum, I have no information at all what the line is. It has equal probability to be everywhere on the circuit. But if I take enough superposition of different angular momentum, then I know information about each line. So I put this cylinder in the hole of a superconductor. First, the superconductor is not a superconductor because temperature is high. Then I reduce the temperature and become the superconductor with this cylinder in the middle. And this cylinder is in a superposition of being different angular momentum, and therefore it's a superposition of having different fluxes. Now I send electrons around the superconductor from the outside and do interference pattern. Enough of them tell me what is the flux. That means that that measurement made the collapse on the angular momentum inside the superconductor. But I claim now that can't happen, because if I have a superconductor, let's do it in the two-dimensional picture, I have a superconductor with all its charges moving here. Inside sits my cylinder, which is just now a circle with charge, and it's rotating one angular velocity or another. When this is rotating, it produces a vector potential outside also. The vector potential is not screened. The only thing that is screened are electric and magnetic fields, but not vector potential. So therefore, if it's in superposition of different fluxes, I see here a vector potential whose integral depends on what rotation that thing has inside. Now I take an electron, see the electron send it here or here around, and see where it appears here. Do it with one more electron. After I collect many, many electrons, I see interference pattern whose maxima and minima depends on what was the flux inside. So if I have enough of them, I can tell from this experiment what is the angular velocity of this circle inside, and therefore I must produce an uncertainty in this position. If initially its position was more or less definite, because it was superposition of many, many different angular momentum. By the end of this experiment, since I found what the angular momentum is by using many electrons, now the position must be smeared. That means that the electrons must somehow find a way to go in and tell the cylinder whether they are moving this way or this way. But because this is a superconductor, we know that any motion of charge here will produce an electric field here that dies exponentially. It goes to zero, no penetration inside. Something that moves outside cannot penetrate inside, no potential, no field, nothing. So per definition, that cylinder here never knows about this electron. It's not allowed to know. So the electrons are not allowed to do it anything, to do it with anything. And nevertheless, we have just shown that they must do something because they've measured, they were able to measure something about it. So there's an asymmetry. It can affect the electrons because it cannot send fields here, but it can still have a vector potential here. So this shows that the non-local effect can be completely disconnected from the local thing. That motion can never produce fields that go through here, but if it has quantized vector potential, it doesn't affect the motion of this, so they don't produce any flux, they are at rest. So the only vector potential here is due to the inside, and that vector potential depends on what is the velocity inside. So I can do experiments outside that tells what is inside, but this experiment cannot penetrate inside, so this is a paradox, okay? And last time I told you about that a little bit shortly, I asked you to solve it. Raise your hands, how many people solve the paradox? Vacuum, I see vacuum here. No, I don't blame you because it's a very difficult paradox. And I can tell you historically, it's very interesting. When I thought about this paradox, it was about 2 years after my thesis. At that time, Bohm was in England, I was in the United States, so I didn't ask him that. But I was wandering around, and any time I found, in any meeting, I found any physicist I thought might be able to answer it, I asked him. Let me tell you the names of the people that I asked and were not able to answer. You don't believe it. First one is Feynman. When I came in 1962 or 3, I came to Los Angeles. I called Feynman and said, oh, I would like very much to meet with you. So I came to his office one afternoon. We sat for a number of hours together. It was my only meeting with Feynman. And then Feynman asked me, what are you working on now? So I told him I work on the foundations of quantum mechanics, have some paradoxes that I like to think about. He said, no, okay, tell me your paradoxes. Well, something very interesting happened. I would start to say a paradox. After 2 or 3 sentences, he would stop and say, stop, I will continue. He would continue writing the paradox. So far, it was very, very nice. It was really brilliant. But then he tried to answer the paradox. And when he tried to answer the paradox, I would stop him after 2 sentences because I thought about it, and said, I will continue. I will continue what he was trying to do and show him why it's not working, okay? So this was people like that. And the main thing that I was interested in to see if he could solve that. And he couldn't solve it. Really, he tried to suggest maybe you should, instead of the superconductor here, maybe you should put many cylinders here, and maybe with that, he did not answer. Now, I met Bardeen from Bardeen, Cooper, and Schiffer. The most expert on superconductivity wasn't able to answer it. I met Onsager in some, you know, all the great people that know about it, he wasn't able to answer it. It was unbelievable. Nobody was able to answer it for a while. And then I hit upon the answer. It turns out it's quite interesting, but I'm not yet going to tell you about it. Now that I told you the paradox more carefully, try to think about it. You will see that it's not trivial Here is an example of paradox that is not trivial, but once you solve it, you learn something very interesting. So I will leave it still open for next time. Okay, another thing that I asked you to do, maybe two sessions ago, was to solve a number of problems with discrete Hamiltonian, because I want to prepare the language, the right language, for quantum theory in Galilean frame, because I claim by learning to think about this quantum theory, we will learn important things about the quantum theory with the Lorentz space-time. So I gave you, for example, the following problem. This is a line, suppose it's a one dimension. In this one dimension, I have the following thing. I have a zero potential here. This is length L. I have a potential V here that I will call large. We'll immediately discuss what it means to say that it's large. Then I have a potential here. This is length L. A potential zero here. And from then on, the potential infinite. V is equal to infinite here. And V is equal to infinite here. And the Hamiltonian is G cosine PL over H bar plus V of X. Cosine PX L over H bar. G times cosine PL over H bar PX L plus V of X. This is the Hamiltonian. So the kinetic term here is the thing that makes the particle jump by L either to the right or to the left each step, right? And V being large is that V over G is very large. So it's always the large or small is the connection between this parameter that has dimension of energy in this parameter. So there are dimensionless parameter. And V being large means that G over V goes to zero. So, and then I ask you to find what happens if I look, I start with a particle here, then I have some amplitude here, I have some amplitude here, and I have some amplitude here. And the question is, what are the amplitudes and what are the energies? Now, you can, in the Heisenberg picture, you can simply see that it's an issue of diagonalizing a rather simple Hamiltonian, a simple method. So let us look at the positional representation. In the positional representation, I have just three vectors. So I will have here three vectors. 1, 0, 0 will be the particle being here. 0, 1, 0 will be the particle being in the middle. And 0, 0, 1 will be the particle being in the right. So then the Hamiltonian in this representation will be, the diagonal term will be 0, V, 0. These are the position dependent of the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is 0, V, 0. And then the other thing will be G, 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 0, 0. That will be a complete Hamiltonian. This thing tells you that the particle jumps from the second position to the third. And this one tells you, okay, you see that this is Hamiltonian that describes G times cosine PL over H bar plus V, right? And then, really what I'm asking you to find the amplitude here and the energy is just diagonalizing this Hamiltonian, right?
Why there's no cosine?
Huh?
By
what?
There is no cosine in the matrix.
The cosine PX over A over H bar is the thing that takes you this position to this position. That's what this term does. This
so
term is
the value of the cosine being plus 1 or minus 1?
What do you mean?
No, it's a
translation.
That one
is that. The coefficient here. Okay. Let me remind you how you do. How Dirac showed. Dirac was the first. Dirac was the first. Dirac was the first one that showed the connection between the Heisenberg and picture representation by doing the following. He said, if you have an operator A, and you want to describe what this operator A does to any vector, you first describe it by what it does to any particular eigenvector, set of eigenvectors. You can choose any set of eigenvectors, say phi 1, phi 2, and phi 3. These are three possible eigenvectors. In this case, the eigenvectors of position. Then you ask, how do I describe what this operator does to any vector? So any vector can be written as a linear superposition of this. Therefore, if I know what this does to any one of these, I will know what it does to any vector. So when A acts on phi 1, what it does, it leaves it equal to A average times phi 1, and then it gets other contributions on orthogonal to phi 1. This is my famous theorem. So really what enters here is this state phi 1, A, phi 2. This is the thing that tells you when A acts on phi 2, how much of it goes to phi 1. So you can describe the matrix A in given representation by what it does on each one of these vectors. So look at this Hamiltonian, and I was asked, what does this Hamiltonian do to a particular eigenstate of position? So if I took this eigenstate of position, I know that what this Hamiltonian does is multiply here by zero because the potential at this position is zero, and it takes this thing, takes this position and sends it here. So this is the term that is here, that it takes the first term and sends it to the second term. So that's how we describe the Heisenberg representation, by saying what the Hamiltonian does to the position representation. And the terms that are entered here are x1, h, x2. These are eigenstates of position. So if I put x1 is here and x2 is here, I ask how the Hamiltonian connect them. It's connected by g, because g cosine makes a jump from one to the other with amplitude g. Yes?
Shouldn't it be g over 2, half this way, half that way?
Yes, you are right. It's g over 2.
How do you kill it going into infinity?
What? I don't kill it. OK, that's interesting. Suppose the particle is here, and I give it an amplitude 1. Then it goes from here to here. I get an amplitude g here that I have to kill. Okay? I put here another amplitude.
When it goes to infinity. Huh? When it goes to the left.
To the left, okay. So when I go from here to here, I see that this brings an amplitude 1 here. Okay? Yeah. But I have another term, which was the original. I put here, suppose there is some amplitude here that I want to prove is 0. So suppose this amplitude is not 0, but minus g over v, which is v is here. Eventually, v will go to infinity, it will be 0. But that's very, very large, but final. So I will say here, there is an amplitude here, which is minus g over v. Multiplied by the energy, by the potential here, it will give me contribution minus g. And that will cancel exactly the probability of the amplitude g coming from here. So to cancel this one, I need here an amplitude which is minus g over v. And when v goes to infinity, I need an amplitude that is 0. But that before, that will be extremely small amplitude, that exactly will cancel this because of the huge potential here. That answer your question? Good. So if you diagonalize this Hamiltonian, you will find what are the energy and what are the amplitudes for this thing. But it would be nice to do it also in the Schrödinger representation, by doing the jumps. I say I start here, I jump here, and they are multiplied by the energy. So I can solve this either attempting to do it by Schrödinger picture, to look directly at the equation for the amplitudes, and that's very complicated. If I do it in the Heisenberg picture, it makes it much nicer to try and solve it by diagonalizing the matrix. So in fact, the Heisenberg picture is always much better once we discuss this crystal. Discrete spaces, okay? So I ask you to see what will happen in this case, and if you solve it, you will see that it's exactly the same as the problem, as the continuous problem of two worlds. You know, if I have two worlds, I have here a box. This is finite barrier, so this is tunneling. These are the two possible states, this plus that and this minus state. These are two possible energy states, and the thing oscillates back and forth. You have exactly the same thing. See all the properties of this in this discrete Hamiltonian. You will see that there are two eigenvalues of energy that are different by a distance that is proportional to 1 over that potential. And if you start the particle at this point, it will go oscillate back and forth between here and here all the time, having extremely small amplitude in the middle. So this will show you how we can think about the discrete thing and learn from it intuition about the continuous thing. That will be the lesson from all these examples that I will show in the discrete case, because that will allow you to think in a new way what happened in the usual Schrödinger picture. So this is something that I now urge you to do. Play around. I will give you two or three examples that try to solve with this Hamiltonian. So this is one of them. Then the other example will be this one. I just have the potential zero at distance L from here to here. Here the potential is infinite. Here the potential is infinite. And the Hamiltonian will be now G times cosine PL over H bar. So if I just had this Hamiltonian, I will see that the only solution, there are infinite degenerate number of solutions, but if I start with a particle here, it will stay here forever with energy zero. If I start it here, it will stay forever with energy zero. So I have infinite number of degenerate solutions, particle being at any of this location with energy zero. Now, if I add to this Hamiltonian some very small epsilon times the usual momentum p, px, and that's now what will happen. So I want you to see that that's what will happen. I start with the particle here. If not for that, it would stay here. But because of that, it starts to move. It comes at velocity, because the velocity from this is just epsilon. So it starts to move slowly with velocity epsilon, moves, until it comes here. And when it comes close to here, it jumps to the other side, and then it goes again and again. So see if you can solve this problem. And the last one that I would like to solve is a problem that corresponds to the crystal problem, as I showed you, but the inverted one in phase space. So I'm going to be showing you now, which is x squared times a lambda. So you have dimension of energy. Plus cosine g times cosine pl over h bar. Plus alpha p, plus epsilon times p. So this will be exactly the opposite thing that is done in crystal. In crystal you have p squared, you have a periodic potential, and then you add a constant force and see what happens. This is the usual thing that is solved as an instant problem. See if you can develop new intuition about what happens in space if you have this Hamiltonian. With this example, you will see that we can do, by discussing this new kind of quantum mechanics that can work only in absolute time, we can develop new intuition of what happens in space to a particle that is very, very different from the Schrödinger picture. Because, and you will see that the thing that intuition that you have to develop here is very different from the idea that you have amplitude in position that behave like waves. No wave is mentioned here at all. We have to develop a new intuition that has to do with these non-local properties in space of this type of variable. And I will see that these non-local properties, once you learn to think about them intuitively, they will be the ones that will be left also when we go to the usual quantum theory in the Lorentzian frame. While the idea of wave that doesn't appear here at all would not come there naturally. It will be some addition that will be not understood from that point of view. And that's why I'm saying, I want to repeat it because I think it's so, so important. When people looked at quantum mechanics, the way it was developed, and everybody took Schrödinger representation as being the correct way to think about it, this way. Then everybody said, okay, what does it mean that we have this wave? What does it mean that we have this particle at the same time at two locations? So, Schrödinger at first thought that what it means is really that the mass and the charge of the particle spread over this wave packet. And he was so happy that when he solved the wave packet for harmonic oscillator and he found that this coherent state doesn't spread, he said, I know this is really the way to think about it. There's really a lump of mass and energy that moves without spreading, beautiful. But then very quickly people showed him, Bohr and Pauli, etc., that this is a very special case. In general, you start with a weapon like this, it starts to spread, and there is no way anymore to say that this mass and energy are localized. They will become spread more and more, and that's how Bohr eventually came with the idea that it's not describing really what happens there, it's a probability to find the whole mass and energy at a given point, okay? So that was the idea to say maybe this is what psi. But if this is what psi, it's describing not what really happens in space, but what we know about it. So then many people say, psi is not describing reality. There is no reality in the quantum domain. Psi is describing only what we are allowed to know about the world, and we are answering our only probability. So we describe only mathematical things, not reality. We are not allowed to talk about reality. That mathematical information of what is moving there through the two slits is only information what we are allowed to know about the particle. This is one escape. That's a terrible escape because that tells that we don't have any intuition of what's happening there. We have to rely on the mathematics that tells us what we are allowed to know about there. But then came another branch, which is even more funny. That branch, which is called the many worlds, is unbelievable when you think about it. We start with a macroscopic classical world. There is only one miserable microscopic electron. That miserable microscopic electron can go this way or that way. I come and look at it and found this way, I start to do one macroscopic thing. Found this way, do another. The minute I start to do one macroscopic thing, I begin to affect the whole world. Very soon, very all the environments will be affected one way or the other. The whole universe will go into being in one location or one location just because of this miserable electron, single electron that was in two locations. This is the picture of the many worlds. It's an unbelievable picture. It tells you you have just a very small sickness. Okay? Being here. And very quickly, the whole universe goes into this crazy idea that either here or here. Unbelievable, but that is really what most people, or I think a very large group of people, including one of my students, who is very strongly for this idea, that this is really what it is. And this is being a slave of mathematics because we can never show that the whole world is in two different places. There is no way to check it, because to check it, you need something from the outside to interfere with the whole world moving from here or here. There is nothing to do there. So we are talking about something that we believe the mathematics is telling us something. We can never check it. We don't understand what it means because we never have the experience that we are in two branches. And these papers tell us that's how you have to think about physics. That's terrible. You agree? Anybody disagree with me when I talk of this way in this group?
I'm afraid to say I'm a little bit disagreeable.
You what?
I'm saying,
yeah, I think you're not being strong enough.
I'm waiting to listen. Yeah.
Shake hands.
Okay, but I did disagree the other direction. Anyone wants to say the many words here?
We have many examples in physics that mathematics dictates what we should observe and we should see. There are many examples of that.
Give me one.
Einstein's theory of relativity.
Here is one.
General relativity is one example of that. But you know, mathematics dictated what we should see.
But once you tell you what you should see, it may be very complicated to do the experiment, but we can envision physically what it means to have general relativity. We can't envision physically what it means that there is an amplitude here and here, unless we say that we ourselves have to go to two different things, and we don't have any picture what it means to be in two different, that I am at the same time here in another place. This is the problem. The problem is this mathematics doesn't lead me to understanding what it means beyond the mathematics. There is no intuition I can develop from it. In the case of general relativity, in the case of field theory, I can develop intuition, what it means to have curvature, what it means, physical intuition above it. Then I can tell a story that doesn't depend on the mathematics itself. Before the mathematics, I did not know what story to tell. But after, for example, I found out that there is not only Euclidean geometry, but there is other geometry, I can begin to develop intuition, what it means. I begin to think, suppose I would live on a surface instead of a surface sphere, then I will understand beyond the mathematics, I will find some pictures, physical pictures, that will tell me what it's curvature, all right? Or what it means to have four dimensions. I can develop intuition about it. But there is no intuition I can develop of what it means for me to be in two different locations at the same time. There is no intuition. There is only mathematical statement. I don't have any experience what it means. Right? So it's not physics.
Yes. Just to take that a bit further, if you can't develop an intuition, the theory will not be fruitful. It won't lead to further discoveries or further advances. And that's the problem. Many universe, or the multiverse, they don't lead you anywhere.
But
they lead you to some nightmare picture, which is
not
completely fruitless. No, it's completely fruitless. So,
yes.
So what's the fruitful
alternative? Did the many worlds view of quantum mechanics ever lead to anything fruitful?
The idea is do the mathematics and talk
about David Deutsch's intuitions about quantum computing.
No,
he attributed it to many worlds.
Interference, and
you can
succeed to do it despite the many worlds.
David Deutsch claims that specific intuition. You can say that's wrong, but it's an example.
No, I think that if you look at the strict space instead of continuum, and you look at what it means to do interference there by understanding the non-locality of the modular variable, that would be my better intuition about what interference means.
Do many worlds respond to your, as you say, inability to understand the thing and calling it unbelievable by saying, well, you actually need infinite number of copies of you?
Hmm?
You need infinite number of copies of you with all these.
I can't envision what it means to have any number of copies of me. I don't accept this as an input. Yes, what do you want?
May I quote somebody whom you know? My previous, former PhD student, Shachar Dolev, I once saw him making a calculation with the many worlds picture. I said, Shachar, you are not going to tell me that you believe in this. And he said there are many cases in which if you want to understand a certain situation in quantum mechanics, use Bohmian mechanics, use many worlds. These are different, use the coherence. These are different ways, aspects to look
and
at.
And all of them are inconsistent because if you try to follow all through what they mean, you run into a problem.
One more word I would like to say about mathematics. You asked for an example. Here is an example. When Dirac solved the Schrödinger equation, and he got this apparently ridiculous plus for the charge of the electron, people laughed at him, or mocked him.
Yeah.
Guess what? 5 years later, Anderson came with the positron. Let me add another example.
Dirac was very good in finding intuition, what it means, physical intuition. He said that if I have a sea full of things, then I can understand what it means to have the pair. And he just made a mistake. It was a mistake because he showed that the hole could be a proton instead of being a positron. That was a stupid mistake that he made. We know, so that Einstein made a mistake in the book.
He assigned a physical reality to a mathematical result.
Yes.
And has he done it correctly? He didn't have the guts to think that it's a
I'm not saying that mathematics can't help you to develop eventually to find new things that after that you can develop intuition about it. But I don't want the mathematics to lead me to something that says you can only understand the mathematics, but not what it means in stories about it. That is the issue.
You need both of them. You need both the Victorian.
Of course. I did not say mathematics is not important. I need also the story. When I'm saying.
I'm going to mention another physicist. When I also negative probability in some of his calculations, then he said negative probability. So in some of his Aharonov. Have you heard there is a physicist named Aharonov?
I have seen
copy
of him.
Right,
right. I never said that it's negative probability, you said it.
I found
there is an ability to find a particle with opposite property.
Sure, you assign to it a physical meaning, and then you say, let's put this minus, we cannot do it to the charge.
Look, I don't argue with you that it's possible to find by mathematics new features of the theory, and then I have to be able to develop above it a story. And the story should be independent of the mathematics. I would like to be able, in case of relativity, without quantum mechanics, I can come to elementary school children that know only about how geometry, only about geometry, trigonometry, that's all, maybe high school. That's all that I need in order to show that the velocity of light is c. You, if you go with velocity shows the velocity of C, you will come back younger than me. How do I do it? I say to this boy, look, there is a big room with walls of glass. And in this big room, there is a guy sitting there. And he does the following game. He sends, the room is very long, so he sends the light rays up. And when the light comes back, he notices it comes back exactly at the time when his heart beat. Okay? So he does it again and again. And he's happy. His heart beats at constant rate. Each time there's a light ray. Now we look at this experiment from the outside, and we move relative to it. If we move relative to it, it's the same as if we move relative to us. So we look at this guy moving in this direction, sending the light ray. The light ray now has to make a bigger distance until it comes back to him. It still comes back to him when the heart beats. But because the velocity of light is the same, and not like in sine waves, then it takes it longer to come there. That means the heartbeat must be slower. This kind of story I can tell without having to go to very complicated mathematics. So I am claiming that it's possible to think about quantum mechanics correctly and being able to tell somebody what the story is. But if I think about it now, I come to a guy and say, look, the story is that you can be at the same time in two different places. He will never be able to understand what it means.
Okay, one last word, because tomorrow I'm leaving for 3 days, so you will be free with me, so just one last advice. We are seeing you, and I would like to join my friend here, we are seeing you knocking down the wave picture instead of the particle picture. I think usually in order to knock down something, you should first acknowledge how beautiful it is, how people loved it. You don't, rather than...
I say it from the beginning because Schrödinger was lucky that the only Hamiltonian nature are P squared plus V of S, in, because of that special thing, he was lucky that then he could find very simple equation that described it. But it was just a pure luck. It had nothing to do with what quantum mechanics is really like, really, okay? So because of that, it was so beautiful, but it was beautiful not because quantum mechanics dictates that that kind of mathematics is correct. It's because of a special limitation to kinds of Hamiltonians that we consider that has nothing to do with what quantum mechanics is really like when we consider absolute time. And if we consider not absolute time, then this equation is not a good one because it tells us what happens at very small positions where we don't have a single particle. So it's an inconsistency from the beginning in this equation.
Would you say the same thing about De Broglie when he looked for the trajectories of the electron? The guy was thinking about waves, mm-hmm. and suddenly he was struck with the beauty of the picture. May I remind you what Einstein said?
Wait. Both Einstein and De Broglie were wrong from the following reason. I know what you're saying. Look, when De Broglie said, look, I have electromagnetic classical theory, and lo and behold, it has also particle properties. Then, why should I have a particle with having wave property? He did not realize that in the electromagnetic wave, you can't see this wave property on a single particle of the electromagnetic wave. If you have a single photon, you can't see all this E and B. E and B, which are the wave properties, can be seen only if you have many, many particles. Therefore, it's wrong to say that when you go to a particle, on a single particle, you should also see a wave, because that was not the case in the other case. A wave can be associated only with many particles, both in the electromagnetic case and in this case. So to say that a single particle is a wave is not understanding what is really happening. So historically, De Broglie said, electromagnetic classical wave has particles, so particles should be a wave. And Einstein said that's beautiful. Both of them were wrong, because single particles can never have a wave property. Neither in the electromagnetic case nor in quantum case. So the fact that two great people say it doesn't mean that it's right, okay? All right, intermission. Hey, look, intermission takes some more.
Monday.